Welcome to the Carefree Black Nerd Podcast, a conversation that is about representation in comics, and related media. I am your host, Ryan Coleman, and in this episode, we will be discussing cowboys and cowgirls. What's up, y'all? I'm your host, Ryan Coleman. Thank you so much for clicking play, for tuning in with me today. We're going to school you, learn you a little something. So this episode, we're actually going to go over two different articles, and I will be linking those in the show notes. I'd like for you to give them a read or just listen to this podcast, and you won't have to. But just in case you want to, they'll be there. Hit me up online, Carefree Blurred on TikTok and on Twitter, Carefree Black Nerd at IG and YouTube. YouTube has some visuals. Sometimes I do a little movie nights and a bunch of other stuff and do a little editing, throwing some stuff together and showing you a day in the life of a nerd. So be sure to check that out. All of that information will be in the link tree, linked in the show notes. Alrighty, you guys, so we're going to get into these two different articles, and I want to discuss cowboys and cowgirls and all that good stuff, because this is a very interesting time, and I'm not going to be specific about what time, but those who know what's up, they know what's up. The end of this month, that's all I'll say. So the first article is from science.org. Now this is written by Andrew Curry, and this is America's first cowboys were enslaved Africans, ancient cow DNA suggests. Cattle may have been imported from Africa centuries earlier than historians thought. And Andrew goes on to say, when you think cowboy, you think of maybe a picture of John Wayne riding a herd across the U.S. West. But the first cowboys lived in Mexico and the Caribbean, and most of them were black. Now, that's the conclusion of a recent analysis of DNA from a 400-year-old cow bones excavated on the island of Hispaniola and at sites in Mexico. Now I'm going to say that this article was released on September 22nd of 2023. And I think the next article that I'm going to get to is actually from 2022, but we'll get there. Now with this, the work published in Scientific Reports also provides evidence that African cattle made it to the Americas at least a century earlier than historians realize. Now, the timing of these African imports to the early 1600s suggests the growth of cattle herds may have been connected to the slave trade. Now, this is said by the in a study by author Nicholas Delso, and I may butcher some of these names. Y'all know how I get down, charges to my head, not my heart. He's an archaeozoologist at the Florida Museum of Natural History. He says, it changes the whole perspective on the mythical figure of the cowboy, which has been whitewashed over the 20th century. Now, the first cattle in the Americas came from Spain, brought by good old Chris, who we do not acknowledge, led to the island of Hispaniola on his second voyage in 1493. Now, more came in subsequent voyages in the early 1500s, and the vast herds that later spread across the Americas, historians have assumed, have descended from the small founding population of about 500 cows. Now, to understand the spread of cattle, Del Sol, I hope I'm saying that right, D-E-L-S-O-L, scoured museum collections for cattle bones from the post-contact Hispaniola and Mexico. The authors compared genetic signatures in the DNA from 21 cows found in early Spanish sites in Mexico and Haiti to known European and African breeds. Now, during the first century of European colonization, most cow bones corresponded with varieties known from Spain, but one bone from the grounds of an early Franciscan convent in the heart of modern-day Mexico called Bellas Artes. This yielded DNA matching a breed of cattle only found in Africa. Now, the sample dates to the early 1600s, more than 100 years before the first historical records of imported African cattle. They say they can show this complex history from evidence we didn't have before. This was said by Eduardo Corona Martinez, an archaeozoologist at the National Institute of Anthropology and History in Mexico City. I know that's right, Eduardo. You better You better do that. Now, he continues, in the first wave, the cattle were Iberian or European, says Corona Martinez, who helped excavate the Bellas Artes site, but was not involved in the news analysis. Later, they introduced cattle from Africa, he said. Now, colonizers may have been trying to adapt herds to tropical conditions in the Caribbean and Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. Del Sol says, bringing cattle that were more adept to hot, wet environments could have been a deciding factor. And the funny thing about all this is, most things, especially in America, can go back to racism. And slavery, like, that is just the nature of the world that it has been built, and it's so wild. And I bring this up not only to, like, get into the history of cowboys and cowgirls and all of that, because it is a very whitewashed history, but it's also, like, the walk with me here. Recently, the Baddest Mitch, the homegirl, she is a podcaster, a comedian. She travels with the Kevin on Stage troupe. She made mention of not knowing or not realizing or wasn't aware that when you're on a cruise ship and there's an ice cream party, more times than not, there may have been more than a couple deaths on the ship. And so they may have run out of space in the morgue. And so they had to store the dead bodies in the freezer. And so, of course, you had to move some things out, ice cream, people like ice cream, instead of letting it melt and go bad or whatever. And I bring that up because she got a lot of flack from folks who were like, oh, you should have known this, or this stupid, or you need, just a bunch of unnecessary stuff twisting her comment, which was, at its core, I did not know that that was the reason why we had ice cream parties. And so it made me think that I've been on a cruise ship before and that hasn't happened. But if it had have happened, I would not have been aware. Like, I would not have drawn that conclusion that, oh, somebody is dead, not just somebody, but a whole lot of somebodies. And how having that spelled out. And I forget the young lady who made the original video. She's a black woman. I follow her on TikTok. She has a lot of great educational content and political content as well. If I can remember or find it, I will link her in the show notes as well. But essentially, you know, she gave a cause and effect, a reason why you may not be aware, but if you do get a random ice cream party on a cruise, more than likely this is the cause of it. And that's something that I was like, it's so obvious, but I don't think I would have ever gotten there on my own if I didn't date or know or dive deep into, like, cruise culture or know somebody who's on a cruise, or like, unless I had that direct line of contact with someone adjacent to a cruise, that would not have been a connection I made in my mind. And so bringing it back, if you're still with me, to a lot of the information that we get, we'll get it whitewashed. Like, we already know that. So it's not like even disputing that. We just know that that's what it is. But a lot of history and a lot of things that we see turned or presented in a certain way, and so you just accept it without even thinking or knowing to make the connection that, although this is right, there should be something else. And what comes to mind is like a Elvis, or like pretty much any white artist who has been able to use the trappings of black folks and gain popularity when black people use the same trappings which are ours and get demonized for it. And the same thing with POCs as well, you know, appropriation being celebrated, but then you living in your own culture and existing in that space is like, oh, you filthy so-and-so. And so that's partly the reason why I wanted to get into this particular history. And of course, you know, the elephant in the room with your girl, your Houston native, deciding to put out music that is folks ain't seeing as black music, or pretty much acting like she's like cosplaying something that she has been her entire career that we've known her. It kind of goes all back to that. Like, you're getting something, and because it's been presented a certain way your whole life, you can't even fathom that it could be something different. You can't even fathom that there could be black cowboys. You can't even fathom that the whole term cowboy and cowhand was not intended for a white face. or a white body. And like, that's, oh my God, that's so interesting. But you know, that's the day and age we live. And even though everybody has a supercomputer in their pocket, like, a lot of people don't, I won't even demonize it, so they don't do the research. Sometimes you just don't know to do it. So getting back to the article here, they go on to say that the arrival of African cattle, meanwhile, coincides with a darker development. Until Europeans arrived, the region's indigenous population had no experience with large domesticated animals such as cows, pigs, or sheep, mainstays of the colonial era diet. As Spanish and Portuguese cattle herds in the New World grew, ranchers needed trained, skilled workers, and African ranchers were more knowledgeable about raising cattle in tropical environment. This is what Del Sol says. Now, we have different lines of evidence that connect African ranchers and Spanish colonies. Now, in the early 1600s, historical records show slave traders targeted African groups familiar with cattle herding, like the Fulani of modern-day Cameroon. The new study shows at least one cow was brought directly from the region at the time, suggesting herders and their cattle might come as a kind of sort of package, a package deal, a number one combo, if you will. Now, modern American cattle are a mix of European and African breeds. Researchers thought the African contribution came via Spain or from cattle imported in the 19th century. Now, he says, here's good evidence that a strongly African genetic marker shows up really early, says Louisiana State University geographer Andrew Schloyer. I know I said that wrong. Andrew S-L-U-Y-T-E-R, Slider, excuse me, who was not involved in the research. It's exciting confirmation of what the archival records were telling us. Corona Martinez says that the study began to fill in a gap in knowledge about how European animals and crops change ecosystems in the New World. He says, not only do we see animals come from European sites, but also from Africa, he says. It's globalization. Now, another part of this that I find so interesting, and this is me, me and my thoughts, is that I consume a lot of media about the cosmos, about how the solar system works, how planets work, the history of the Earth, the history of the world. And it's so humbling to think that, yes, we're existing in this day and age, 2024, we're on social media, we have jobs, we have cars, we take trips, we wear nice shoes and this and that. And to think of like the evolution of humankind, of the Earth, of animals, and to think of like how many species of animals there are out there that we have yet to lay eyes on, and how a lot of what we are told and fed and thought that like shapes our worldview, a lot of it does not take into account those indigenous folks who experience these things. Because, of course, the storybooks are written by the victors. The wars are told from the mouths of the ones who won. And so, like, I'm reading through this and I'm going through having my own, like, surreal experience where there are so many things that are presented to us that maybe 90% true, maybe 100% true, but there's a vast amount of things that just aren't. And let's make this concise. I watched the video and I wish I had have saved it. I'm kind of kicking myself, where the young man explained that when you look at animals and the way and the animals that we have, and say something is like never before seen or something like that, and he's like, well, what does that look like? And this is a terrible retelling of what I heard on this video, but that we're taking what's in these books and saying, okay, this is the thing that we haven't seen before, but you're only taking into account these white folks who got together, made these books, said this is what we see, this is what's categorized, this is this, that, and the third. But not, he mentioned that you're not including the indigenous folks and their language and their viewpoint, and not just on a basic, oh, colonization, like that, we get that happened, not to disregard it, but that's not the point of the conversation. What he was getting at is that we have all of these things that we see, that we know, that are documented, but there's so much more that, because of the exclusion of indigenous people and their language and their history and their storytelling and this, that, and the third, there could be so much more that we just do not know. Or at the very least, this thing that you see as someone, let's just say an alligator. Oh, this is an alligator. It was first found on the shores in 1832. But if you consider what the indigenous people, and not just in the Americas, but just worldwide, have experienced, that alligator could have had an entirely different name, an entirely different look, and have already been perceived and documented by indigenous people. But what we're getting is this from a history book and from a book that acts as if life began once these folks laid eyes on it, and now they're labeling these items. Oh, this is alligator, this is giraffe, is such and such. And this is, again, is a terrible retelling of such a good video. And if I can find it, I'll link that as well. But I thought that was so interesting. And when you look at these findings that these folks have come up with between the DNA of cattle from Spain and from Africa and from Europe, it's like, imagine if colonization never happened and these animals were to just evolve on their own. What would a cow look like in Africa? What would a cow look like from Spain? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, what would these things look like? And then down to the like DNA structure, not just how they appear, like what would the diets be? Is now the milk richer because there's no, I don't know, genetic altering of like interbreeding cows and changing them into different areas and this and that. So there's conversations for good, bad, and the like when it comes to these animals and how things have progressed. And I don't know, I just find that so fascinating. So thanks for walking with me on this tangent, because oh my god, it's just, and then another thing, like animals don't talk like we do. We cannot understand them, so who's to say? Now, this is me getting into my nerdy side, but who's to say that there's not a breed of cow that's like, motherfucker, I've been here forever. You know what I'm saying? There used to be another cow that was pink and white and had stripes down his stomach, but we got rid of them motherfuckers in the Great War, the Bovine War of 1432. Like, there's so many things that we just do not know, and when we rely on simply these particular people who are... whatever, I don't know. So y'all get what I'm saying, and if you don't, hit me up on Twitter, Carefree Blur, CBNPod, hashtag CBNPod. So Schleuder says that they should find help shifting fundamental misconception around the origins of iconic American figure, the cowboy. Innovations like herding cattle from horseback and the lasso appeared first in the Americas at the time when most cowboys were enslaved Africans, spreading to Europe only later. It's debunking the idea enslaved Africans were simply the workers, the brawn, not the brains. Schleuder says, oh, I can't get that name right. They created a lot of novel techniques. And that's essentially it. Like, there's always this pushback against wokeness and about, like, whatever. That word has been perverted beyond recognition. It does not, whatever. I'm not going to get into that. But a lot of things, people are quick to run with this very particular narrative when the history is out there. And to bring it down to like the nerd level, bring it down a little bit lower to, you know, what we're talking about, X-Men 97 was announced. X-Men 97's trailer has hit, and there's been tons of conversation about X-Men 97. Oh my god, since it happened. And those of you listening, I know at least half of you know what I'm talking about. And one particular conversation that keeps being popped up, which is so interesting, is that people are talking cash shit about Scott Cyclops. And now I know I'm way behind in my Krakoa X-Men reading, but even before Krakoa, Scott ain't been no pushover. Scott ain't no kiss ass. Scott ain't the Scott that a lot of people have in their minds. And I know when it comes down to comics and when it comes down to like nerd culture, a lot of it is just who's your fave and how do you defend them. But other things are just pure facts. I'm not talking this Omega level mutant can wipe out this one, this, that, and that. No, if we're looking at the hardcore facts of the things that have happened in the books, they're like, that ain't Ben Scott's ministry. And they're like, oh, he's this terrible cop and fuck him and this, that, and the third. And I'm just like, I don't have a whole lot of room to talk because of the Krakoa stuff and me being behind, but like, come on, you can't honestly think that the Scott from Fox's animated series 1992 is the same Scott we have in 2024. Like, come on, don't make me defend this motherfucker. Come on. So again, people running with a particular narrative without like going in and doing the research, and not even that you're not going in and doing the research, but you're running with a particular narrative. And then when people tell you that's not how this is, and these people are clearly, for all intents and purposes, experts on this topic, like the Scott thing, because these are people who are, that's their favorite character, or at the very least, they're just up to date in the comics. But you, sir or ma'am, or they, whoever, is sitting back talking cash shit, and you do not have the requisite information and knowledge needed to come up with that conclusion. Like, if you read all that and was like, no, I still think he a punk ass motherfucker because of this, then the third, then you have more of a leg to stand on, because you at least know the material to be able to say, no, that's not it, and this is why I think so, even if you're wrong. But I digress. So let's just switch hands a little bit. We're going to go to another article. Now, this article is on Shonda's website. She's on Shondaland, and this is written by Janice Littlejohn. Now, or Janice. I'm talking about Janice. Janice Littlejohn is a Southern Californian-based writer who has contributed to Miss Magazine and Medium. And on Shondaland's website, she's written a few articles. Few good ones. Playing with Mud taught her about ancestry, how to experience the lasting legacy of Harriet Tubman, the tree and me, like really, really good stuff. But we're going to focus on this article she wrote, which is Exploring the Hidden History of Black Cowboys and Cowgirls. Whew. Now, this one was published on March 17th of 2022. She says, in museums and galleries across the country, the once unknown stories of black cowboys and cowgirls are galloping towards the light. Now, walking into the Witt Museum exhibition, Black Cowboys, An American Story in San Antonio, Texas, I was surrounded by the faces and stories of black men, women, and children, some enslaved, some free, who were an integral part of ranching and the cattle drives in Texas long before Civil War and throughout the turn of the 20th century. There were things I recognized, such as photos of legendary black cowboys, Nat Love and William Bill Pickett, and a poster for the Netflix film Concrete Cowboys, starring Idris Elba, his pearly white smile beaming underneath that white Stetson hat. However, situated between the icons and Hollywood persona are countless others who contributed to the American West and the U.S. cattle industry have long been buried. Lord. She says, Ronald W. Davis II, a PhD candidate in the history department at the University of Texas in Austin, who curated the Black Cowboys exhibition with longtime arts advocate Araneta Pierce. Oh, I hope I said it right. Araneta Pierce says the legacy of black cowboys has been denigrated, marginalized, and erased. The exhibition, which runs through April 16th, again, this is 2022, showcases how deeply black cowboys were part of the ecology and economy of the Americas. We're making sure we do justice to these people, Davis says, who were denied justice in their lifetime. And then when I look at the photos of this exhibit, it looks and feels a lot, which I'm sure it's just by nature of being a museum exhibit, but you guys remember in Falcon and the Winter Soldier when the end, when Falcon went to that museum and there was finally a, I don't know, not monument, there was a something dedicated to Eli Bradley. Like, you remember that? Yeah, so if you think of that, this is what it kind of feels like. And I am a sucker for people getting their shine, getting their roses, getting, you know, even if it has to be in death, but preferably in life. And going through this article in like getting into the history of black cowboys and cowgirls, it really sits heavy on my chest. Like, I have this podcast and I'm talking about comics, related media, things that highlights and celebrates black folks and POCs and their contributions in comics and where they've popped up and been seen in pop culture and stuff. And it's like, am I doing enough? Is there more that I can do? And like, why is there not more mainstream imagery of those who are? Because yes, I have this podcast and I'm doing this work, but there are tons of other people out there who are doing work in other ways, much like this article, much like people getting into the history of country music, of black people being cowhands and cowboys and cowgirls, of getting into hell the DNA and what do you call it, epinology of like cattle, being able to trace them back to Africa. Like, there's so many people doing such good work in so many different legs of the world, period, that I just have to do my part and try to get at least the word out. So of course I'm going to, as I said before, link these articles here in the show notes, because I want you to be able to go through and go on your own little deep dive rabbit trail of you know, of these cowboys and their history for yourself, you know, forever you like. But man, I just feel like it's not enough. So 1 in 4 cowboys in the American West were African American, a surprise to many because black cowboys were never seen in old Western movies or prominently featured in history books. The fact is, enslaved people of African descent worked with horses and cattle from their arrival in New Spain in the late 1500s to emancipation in 1865. In Texas prior to the Civil War, enslaved people made up 30% of the population, and freed black cowhands contributed vastly to the development of the cattle industry, honing skills they learned on ranches and trails. Hector Basie, a former enslaved ranch hand who was emancipated at 14, wrote about his life on the Western frontier in his 1910 memoir, The Negro Cowboy. A portion of his 34-page manuscript is reenacted in a moving portrayal by actor Eugene Lee at The Wit, describing the dangerous but exhilarating work of the cattle trails. Now, this is an excerpt of his manuscript. I'm going to try to do it justice, but y'all don't laugh. Okay. After I was released from slavery, I went to Harris County. There I commenced the cowboy's life in earnest. In babyhood days, the call of the winds and the wide-eyed cattle appeared to me. It seemed to understand them as no one else. Even though they looked wild to others, they looked docile and tame to me. They were my silent friends, and I loved to be with them. That made me take up the life I have led probably more than anything else. I loved to drive cattle on the open plains and to ride the worst bucking broncos that could be found. In the early days, Houston was quite a cattle market. Oftentimes, I drove cattle to this market. In those days, a cowboy did not have dozens of different mounts, but was lucky if he had 2 horses and a pack of mule. Ooh. In that time, horses were hard to get that one could handle to do the business. The cowboy who had more to eat than hard track and bacon was fortunate. We usually camped in wherever sunset found us and cooked our meat over a fire and a fork stick, and sometimes we had to eat it raw. When we were shorthanded or had signs of thieves or Indians, both infested that part of Texas at that time, and neither was mean enough to do anything. Interesting. That's interesting. I would really like to get my hands on the full manuscript, especially being like from the horse's mouth, so to speak. A number of artifacts for the Wit's Black Cowboy exhibition were sourced from across the country, including the Pro Rodeo Hall of Fame and Museum of the American Cowboy in Colorado Springs, Colorado, as well as the private collection of Larry Callies, C-A-L-L-I-E-S, I think it's Callies, a former mail carrier and rodeo rider who used his life savings to build the Black Cowboy Museum in Rosenberg, Texas. This is located about 35 miles southwest of Houston. Callie's 3-room museum is an attempt to fill in the gaps where the history has omitted the stories of local black cowboys, including Callie's own cousin, Tex Williams, who in 1967 is believed to have been the first black cowboy to win the Texas High School Rodeo Championship following the desegregation of high school rodeos. Which again is so interesting how we have to put in all this work just to fill in the gaps of history that is ours. That is so frustrating, and I'm not gonna lie, at times it gets very, it weighs very heavy on my heart that we have to do this. And this is, I released an episode some time ago about me being an author and a writer and getting my story out and writing books and just then the third, and it should be like two or three episodes before this one. But I bring up that one because the art of storytelling is not dead, but I don't think it's appreciated as much as it should be. There is a lot that goes into filling in those blanks when you don't have a firsthand account of things that happen. And it's already hard enough if you just look at, like, what was your grandma doing? Well, if she kept a journal, then, you know, you're probably pretty good. But if she passed away and you don't have that first person right there in your face that you can ask these questions to, it's going to be kind of hard to fill in those gaps. I think of something like Black Cake, the Hulu series that's based off a book that's, you know, about these kids filling in the blanks of their mother's life before she came, before she had them. And that's already hard enough to do. But then you're also looking at like centuries and decades and all this time of trying to make up not just, oh, my grandma didn't have a journal, but like people who were seen as property for a very long time who were not able to get their own stories. Like this, my goodness, I commend anyone who's doing the work, and I hope that at least by hitting record and uploading this, that someone gets a little bit more history that they didn't have before, or that it causes a spark where now you feel like you have to go and kind of look for more information that maybe you weren't aware of before. Because this, again, I tell you, this sits heavy on my heart more times than not. Now, the image of the cowboy is so vitally American, says Davis, and has been cultivated in a way to be white American. So that when we see these images of black cowboys, it's antithetical to how we understand America's past, because America's past is told in a way that is uniformly white. The exclusion of Mexicans and African Americans from a lot of that narrative is sometimes jarring for people. Now, one of the things I appreciated most about the exhibition, she said, was its inclusion of women who worked as cowhands and ranchers. Black women worked alongside enslaved and freed men, and many were highly skilled ranch hands who took care of cattle and other animals. Among the most notable women featured in the exhibition is Henrietta Williams Foster, known as Aunt Riddy. Aunt Riddy Foster, a legendary cowhand who lives in Refugio County in South Texas, was a formerly enslaved woman born in Mississippi. She was considered a tenacious, tough-as-nails woman who would ride her horse saddle-side in long skirts and could perform the same work as men. Simi Rydolph and Monroe Bailey Shaw, two cowboys interviewed by historian and author Louis S. O'Connor in 1982, said she could throw calves and do anything else a man could, and maybe better. O'Connor's oral history, which is featured in the Wits exhibition, is the basis for a chapter in Foster in the book Black Cowboys of Texas, which, of course, I'm going to have to get my hands on this book. Now, taking in the black and white photo of Aunt Riddy, her stern, furrowed brow hovering over her eyes confirmed she was no one to fool with. Foster and other black women cowgirls have become a source of inspiration for local artists from the nearby Edison High School, who created vibrantly covered paintings. Vibrantly colored paintings of themselves as modern day hat wearing, steel roping cowgirls as part of the art series I See Myself in the Past, I See Myself in the Future, which hang in the Robert J. and Helen C. Clyburg South Texas Heritage Center at the Wit. Texas is rich and full of history, and for me to be here and have been here for so long, of course, we're going to understand that COVID knocked some things around, but I would really like to like experience some of this. I don't know anybody out there who know about a rodeo nearby, or if I got to go to San Antonio, but let me know what's what, because I need to throw on my 10-gallon hat, put on my little shoes with my cowboy boots, and get to honky-tonking, because this, just again, going through this article and going seeing the imagery and finding all of these resources is really, it's doing something to me. It is. Now, there are several other destinations where the history of black cowboys and cowgirls is being explored in the U.S. In 2001, Gloria Austin and her husband Jim opened the National Multicultural Western Heritage Museum in Fort Worth, Texas, which is like super close, which is also home to the National Cowgirl Hall of Fame and features African-American inductees of the West, including ranchers Molly Taylor Stevenson, both senior and junior. Okay, shout out to them. Colorado pioneer woman Clara Brown, former U.S. Marine and equestrian trailblazer Patricia E. Kelly, and Southern California real estate broker Maisha Akbar, who founded Compton Richlands Farms and established the nonprofit Compton Junior Posse Youth Equestrian Program. My goodness, y'all better do the work. Now, Black cowboy history is also celebrated at the Buffalo Soldiers National Museum in Houston, Texas, the Great Plains Black History Museum in Omaha, Nebraska, and Denver's Black American West Museum and Heritage Center, which has been closed for remodeling and is expected to reopen later this year with new interactive exhibits and updated facilities. Now that, of course, I don't know for certain, considering this article is a couple years old. We're still going out in the community to do presentations, notes Elise Clark, a board member who also served as docent. I think there's a reclamation of both the black image and the black migration in the 20th century and during World War II, Davis notes. What happened was that these black cowboys were also migrating for work, and they took black culture with them. That's why you have these black riding groups in Philadelphia and LA, because that is a direct result of migration from Texas and Oklahoma. That always been there, but hidden. The black Western mythology lives beyond galleries, museums, and historical spaces as well. Caitlin Gooch, a modern horse rider known as the Black Cowgirl, promotes awareness of the legacy of black equestrians through her nonprofit Saddle Up and Read. I know that's right. Saddle Up and Read, which takes place on her farm in North Carolina. She focuses on encouraging kids of color to read. Breonna Noble, who became famous in 2020 for riding her horse through a George Floyd protest march in Oakland, California, hosts ride-alongs and teaches sustainable pioneering of livestock and horses in inner-city spaces for her urban cowgirl ranch. Again, this is our culture. This is us. I remember a time I was living in Atlanta, and I was on the what is deemed as the not-so-favorable side of town, but that is, of course, where the HBCUs is, because I attended Clark Atlanta University, and there were... You could easily, on a random day, see folks riding horses. Of course, you had, it was a little, it wasn't jarring. It was, the first time I saw it, it almost felt surreal or ethereal, like some sort of like modern day fantasy fairy tale thing. Because I grew up riding horses, but I'm from the Midwest. And so that was nothing for me. Riding horses, doing like skiing and just all that other mess. And then coming here and being in this space that's so metropolitan, it's such a city's city where all these buildings are close to each other. It's densely populated. And then to see that in a space that wasn't a farm from up north, or where you could drive down the highway, let's say going from Detroit to the Upper Peninsula, and you can drive by countless farms and see all this cattle and all these horses and all these essentially cowboys and cowgirls just riding around. Like, that's what I was used to seeing. So to see this in the city, where I'm walking to McDonald's from campus and there's just four folks on horses just riding down the street, but you also got these loud cars and vibrant music and colorful, it's just, it was such a space that felt like home. I bring that up to say, like, this has always been us. And when you get to books that are printed en masse, that has to now be in these schools, that people are reading about the history of America and cowboys, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it doesn't take into account the actual people who were there, these people of color, these black people who you're writing out and whitewashing a history. There are so many folks, myself included, that did not get a particular understanding or education about things until we hit college, which feels so terrible, because what about the people who don't go to college? What about the folks who can't afford to go to college? What about the people who just don't friggin' want to? Give the but I digress. Let's get back. Now, in February, the team at the Bill Pickett Invitational Rodeo, which features black ropers and riders, saddled back up for the start of their first live tour since the outbreak of the coronavirus pandemic, with upcoming showcases including Los Angeles, Oakland, Atlanta, and the Washington, D.C. area. Last year on Juneteenth, CBS televised the rodeo, the rodeo, making the first time any broadcast network aired the event. With all the racial issues we've seen in our society, people are more encouraged and seeking to learn more about this history, says Valeria Howard Cunningham. What a name. Valeria Howard Cunningham, who helped found the rodeo in 1984 in honor of legendary Texas rodeo bulldogger Bill Pickett, who became famous for subduing steers by biting their upper lips. Like, girl, the nerve. Subduing steers by biting their upper lips. Oh my, yeah, he deserved whatever award, accolade, whatever they want to get in him, that man deserved it. He earned it. Now, Pickett is often viewed as more of a performer than a cowboy by some purists, but he is arguably the best known black cowboy in the U.S. history, albeit nothing like the character portrayed in Netflix Western action flick The Harder They Fall, which featured the names of Pickett, Rufus Buck, Nat Love, Stagecoach, Mary Fields, and other iconic African Americans of the Old West, but little else bearing any resemblance factually, a point of contention for some historians, which I'm with them there, because at sometimes you just got to get who's best for the job. But when you're doing a historical anything, like, you got to get as close to the source material as possible. That's my personal opinion. But we'll move on. When we misrepresent history, we spent a lot of time as docents correcting that history, because it's confusing to people who don't know these people already, says Clark, who is working on a project about books and plays, fields, and reenactments across the country. It takes a long time to dig up any black history. I've been at it for decades, literally digging up the history on these people. If you don't respect the true history for people, then you get distorted history. And that's what I am saying. We have to fill in the gaps where we can, and we have to do so much work to fill in the gaps that we're already a step behind. And so to have an actual real person that you're portraying, and not to do them justice and making them look as closely like that person as possible, you're doing a disservice. Like, this ain't animated where you can just draw somebody to look like them. You're doing a live action, whatever. It's disgusting. Okay, so if you don't respect the true history of people, then you get distorted history. I agree. And cowboy movies are already distorted because there are no black men in old westerns. For those familiar with the impact of black cowboys and cowgirls, they hope sharing the history in cultural institutions, at events, and online helps to spread not only knowledge but positivity. African Americans have so much to be prideful about other than overcoming slavery, Cunningham says. This country would not exist today if it was not for African Americans. All aspects of business, life, everything. We have got to change how we look at our history as not something we overcame, but something that we built with pride. And that's really that. I stand behind pretty much everything that was said in this article. And again, it is a very sobering, humbling, heavy feeling to go through history where you can, where it's been uncovered, and experience it and see those gaps in your own history that have been left out. It is so good to be able to reclaim at least a small part of that. I would have loved to have been able to visit this exhibit, to see this in person, to hear these people's voices, to see these reenactments that these young girls in high school did, like to read that manuscript in its entirety. Like, it's so much rich history out there that just gets bulldozed by being whitewashed. And then when it is being reenacted or given a chance, then it's also altered to look what Hollywood deems to be desirable. A lot of things, you have to look at indie projects. You got to look at how people who are doing the work on their own and getting the story out as unbiased as possible. It's like, it's a lot of work. And again, I applaud everyone who is doing that work. And I hope that this issue of Carefree Black Nerd has given you somewhere, some jumping off point, where even if it isn't black folks and being cowhands and cowboys and cowgirls, that it gives you some idea to look further or deeper into something else that you may not have known had a deeper, richer history to it. Because again, history books are written from the POV of the victors and not those who have suffered at the hands of them. So hopefully this wasn't too heavy, but if it was, oh well. So thank you all for listening. I do hope that you'll join me for the rest of this cowboy, cowhand, southern reclaiming the country roots series. And until next time, stay carefree, stay nerdy, stay geeky, and hit me up on social media. Again, Carefree Blurred on TikTok and Twitter, Carefree Black Nerd on IG and YouTube, and walk with me. Give me any suggestions that you may have, things you want to hear about, know about, you want me to talk about. And be good to yourselves. All right.